On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, we ask whether corporate America could benefit from some of the lessons in the U.S. military. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting. My guest today is Lieutenant Commander Jeffrey Lay, the author of Top Gun on Wall Street, Why the United States Military Should Run Corporate America. Jeff, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I'd like to start with the title, Why the United States Military Should Run Corporate America. You're probably not literally suggesting that all leadership positions in the private sector be taken over by former military officers. So what do you really mean by that?
And I'm glad that you noticed that. It is tongue-in-cheek, but I would tell you that when we were in the service, we were very much harder on ourselves than others would be. And we did have a belief, and I think it was a little naive from a distance, that perhaps the United States military should run corporate America when we saw the way that certain things were run. But what we're really saying is that the tenets that we learn in the military are tenets that should be applied to corporate America. And if they were, corporate America would run so much better.
So you've seen some things that indicate that the leaders of corporations, large or small, are not being hard enough on themselves?
I think that's accurate. And ultimately, where I come from after 24 years of military service, I can tell you something about leadership. And leadership is really about taking responsibility first and credit last. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. We need leaders who will get out in front of a problem, fess up early, and take responsibility rather than placing fall guys. And that's one of the real beginning tenets, that tenet of accountability.
Okay. Let's jump back in time a little bit. If you could tell me briefly, when did you enter the military? What was your reasoning at the time? And then some of those things that you learned that you think are applicable to businesses and investors.
Well, it was a long journey. I actually began in high school as a freshman. We had a Navy version of a Reserve Officer Training Corps in our high school, or the called the Junior ROTC program. So I really feel like I'd been in the Navy most all of my life. I left in the very early 80s, right as President Reagan was coming to office, and I entered as an enlisted man, did that for a year before being accepted to the United States Naval Academy. And in the first year of military service, it was really just learning about the military way, about being disciplined and following orders, etc. But once I entered the United States Naval Academy, there were four strong years there where I really got to learn about reverence for an institution. And that was kind of the founding.
So tell me more about what you mean by reverence, if you would.
Institutions are places where we work, but they're also places that built America. And the United States Naval Academy is a good proxy for the institutions of great organizations like a Lehman Brothers, for example, and perhaps we might talk about that a little bit later. But the men who built the United States Navy, starting in the beginning with the father of our Navy, John Paul Jones, he is the kind of man who really was a leader at a very young age, and we learned at the Naval Academy to have reverence for our institution. If you were disgruntled as a Naval Academy midshipman, it wasn't as though you could pack your bags and run off to a different United States Naval Academy. It was your institution, and there was a real loyalty, not just to the institution, but to the men who actually built the institution, and that's what I mean by reverence. That's a little lacking in corporate America.
In the sense that there's sort of a musical chairs approach to leadership positions, like somebody who's working as an executive over at, 20th Century Fox will all of a sudden jump ship and take a new position at Universal Studios, something like that?
Yeah, very well said. So there's a lot of cross-decking, if you'd like to use a Navy term, where individuals can go from being a president of one organization, or I dare say a CEO, maybe even run a company into the ground and still have a good reputation and be brought in to run yet another organization. You run a ship aground in the United States Navy, you're going to lose your job and not get command of another ship. And that's really what separates the Navy, the military, from corporate America. It's that accountability.
Okay. And then I guess you found yourself moving into a leadership position yourself?
I did. I was blessed after graduating from the Naval Academy to go into flight training. And over the course of several years, I deployed few times overseas. But I went on to ultimately graduate from the United States Navy Fighter Weapons School, which we affectionately know as Top Gun. Mm-hmm. And you would think that after graduating from Top Gun, you'd really kind of climbed your Mount Everest. But what's interesting about graduating from Top Gun is that you really just get more responsibility. And that's really the true mark of leadership, it's continuing to take an increased level of responsibility and accept the exceptionalism that's expected of you.
Did it ever seem like it was too much to take on?
There are times when it did seem like it was too much, but ultimately you have a nation to defend, and you had this concept in the pit of your stomach that really resonated around the theme of service before self. So it was difficult and the hours were long, but you really feel like you were working for something and the work that you were doing was incredibly important. Now, in this case, it was the defense of a nation. But more than that, as a Top Gun graduate, you were held to account to develop others in your squadron. And the interesting side of that is that you had a vested interest. Ultimately, something could happen to you. If you have a family, or you have children, et cetera, you need to leave your Navy in the hands of capable folks. So you weren't just there looking out for yourself. You were always trying to make the people around you better than yourself if they could be.
If we were going to take that as a metaphor to running a business, would the people in your squadron be, you know, fellow employees? And then would defending the nation be similar to increasing shareholder value?
I think that's accurately stated. So anyone that's in your organization is your squadron mate. And rank in the military, which most people would never understand, doesn't really have a place in the aura of accountability. In fact, we took accountability a little bit further. We actually believed in something that we always highlighted called mutual accountability. And the way that we achieved that was once we ended a mission or we ended a brief or we had a discussion, we would literally drop the rank. You could be the commander or the Top Gun graduate in the squadron, or you could be the new person that checked in the squadron. Rank didn't matter. If somebody had done something wrong, they were held to account. We discussed it so that we didn't repeat our mistakes. That's sorely lacking in corporate America.
And in the book, you write about four words that every naval battle commander lives by and which can be used by today's investors to help them achieve success, one of which you just mentioned. They are plan, brief, execute, and debrief. Could you walk me through how that works?
No question. Plan, brief, execute, debrief is really the secret sauce of naval aviation. It might surprise you to know that one year alone in the early 1950s, the United States Navy lost over 770 aircraft in one single year. That's more than 2 aircraft per day for an entire year.
In the 50s, wow.
Could you imagine? And we weren't at war. Could you imagine us losing 2 banks a day for an entire year?
No.
The Navy really sat back and they reflected on this and they thought to themselves, you know, we have a cultural problem here. We're developing new technologies, but ultimately it comes down to culture. So this concept of plan, brief, execute, debrief was put into place. And this is how it works. First, you have to set an objective, and the objective has to be clear, measurable, and attainable. And once you've done that, then you can craft a plan based on the resources at hand and the objectives that you've defined. And with a plan in hand, you can actually brief that plan so you aren't doing things by the seat of your pants. And then execution becomes second nature. But ultimately, you have to come back and you have to learn from your lessons and not repeat mistakes. And that's where the debrief comes in.
Yeah, I'm guessing that debrief is probably the part that's missing from most current operations.
It is, and particularly a rankless debrief. I was speaking with an internet executive today, and they were telling me that one of the things that they've done exceptionally well is they've gone in, they've had what they called a harmless post-mortem, where they don't hold people to account. And once people are really given that freedom to explain what they've done or things that they could do better, they really open up and they don't feel threatened that they're going to lose their job. I think it's really important for American corporations to adopt that new mindset if we're going to propel our nation forward.
I'm curious, when you're in the planning stage, is there a lot of room for revising the plan after it's been approved?
It can be time compressed, and the plan does develop through time. One thing you might like to understand, though, is the amount of planning that goes into a flight. It's often said that for about every 1 hour flight time that a fighter pilot experiences, he or she will probably plan for about 5 hours on average for that mission. And you're going to brief the plan that you develop for maybe 45 minutes to an hour, maybe an hour and a half if it's a serious strike mission that you're going to be going on. But what you're really doing in the planning stage is you're looking at the objectives that you set, and you're coming up with the best plan, and you're testing your idea, and you're coming up with contingencies so that you can brief these before you run straight into execution. And it's that running straight into execution that corporate America and oftentimes organizations on Wall Street do every day. And that's really kind of a crime to the shareholder.
Mm. It looks like you actually got to experience some more private sector business stuff while you were still operating in the military. How did that go down?
Well, what happened with me was I was in the Navy for 19 years following graduation and including some time there in Annapolis. before I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, I had cancer, and good news is I beat it, and I went back to flying. But after I went back to flying, I thought to myself, you know, I've had kind of my scare in life, if you will. There might be something else out there for me. So I did decide that I was going to transition into corporate America, but I didn't give up the flying. I actually flew in the Air National Guard with the state of Ohio back in my hometown. I flew F-16s for 5 years as I worked into my transition. It was an interesting time for me because I was an instructor pilot out in F-16 unit, and I was working with the same individuals, the same quality people that I'd worked with in the United States Navy, but I was getting to see a different side of America that I hadn't seen in those previous 19 years, kind of being sheltered in the active duty service. And it was that interesting five-year blend of the transition before I went off to Wall Street that really kind of opened my eyes to some of the inefficiencies that existed and the opportunity to espouse the virtues of military service.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of people in our audience have examples they're already thinking of in their minds, but could you give me some of the more shocking ones that either angered or depressed you or made you just baffled?
The one that always baffled me the most was the amount of obfuscation that people would come up in senior positions of leadership. You know, in the military, we all hear the same term that everyone else hears in sports, and that is that there's no I in team. Well, I can assure you there's no I in Top Gun either. And the thing that always bothered me most was the fact that you would have your CFO take the fall if you had a bad earnings report, or maybe a Wall Street bank had been trading and suffered large losses, and they paraded someone out and maybe took out the mid-level management. But I can tell you something about United States Navy aircraft carrier. If the thing ran aground and the captain was asleep, you wouldn't just relieve the navigation officer for the day. The captain's going to lose his job. So ultimately came down to this lack of responsibility, not just to the organization, but to the people below you. There's too much obfuscation and the creation of fall guys going on in corporate America for my taste.
One of the lines that popped out at me was when you wrote, investors should think like fighter pilots. What does that mean?
Fighter pilots are always assessing risk. People think that being a fighter pilot is really about bravado, but it couldn't be anything further from the truth. You're entrusted with an incredibly valuable asset, and you're giving this asset at a very young age. Could you imagine if more and more of our population were actually handed over $32 million to control on an everyday basis? And this is what's happening for those who come out of the Ivy League schools of America and go to work on Wall Street. But if you're an investor, or if you're somebody working on Wall Street, if you've just come out of college and you have a high GPA, et cetera, there is no substitute for the thought process of a fighter pilot. And a fighter pilot is always looking at the downside first. That's really the way investors should think. They should stop looking at the greed componentry. And I'm not saying to be fearful, but they should always assess the risk and then weigh the risk to the rewards. We wouldn't just fly to an engagement, if you will, with a Russian-made MiG fighter over a foreign country if we didn't need to. If we could come back and live to fight another day, we would do that. That's why we don't lose aircraft routinely. We just don't hurl ourselves into a dogfight senselessly.
Wow. Okay. So investors want to be looking at the value of a company and, you know, do their own research and find out if they think it's a good investment. And some of the things that you've been talking about, like obfuscation and not taking responsibility. If I'm looking to invest in a company and I find through the history that, oh, I don't know, it's JP Morgan Chase and they managed to lose $2 billion seemingly overnight and nobody's really taking responsibility for it, that's a bad sign, right?
Well, it would be a bad sign. And JP Morgan, in fact, actually, I think they have taken a little bit of responsibility. If you look at a man like Jamie Dimon, he came out and flat out said, you know, listen, something stupid happened here. So I think there's some accountability that's coming to the forefront. Some leadership is being exhibited, but time is going to tell on that particular trade. You know, it's something where the bank has to be involved in some of these lines of business, but it's really around, do we repeat our mistakes? You know, it's not the crime of committing mistakes. I like to say that there are such things as crimes of omission and commission. And what I mean by that is, listen, people make honest mistakes. And if you're making an honest mistake and you have the courage and more importantly, if you have a culture and environment in which you can communicate that mistake, then you can actually control it. But if you're reading over a company's history and you find that they're repeatedly making mistakes, that tells you something about the culture and it tells you something about the way your shareholder cash is going to be handled.
Yeah. I guess maybe the worst case scenario would be a company's repeating mistakes, but hiding it so well that we don't know about it until it's way too late.
Absolutely. And I would also say that investors have got to put in the work. You know, you can't just be swimming with the crowd. You literally need to get in, dig through the 10-K, do the work. These things are sometimes, dozens, if not hundreds of pages long. And so many times everybody just wants the hot pick, et cetera. This is why a man like Warren Buffett is so successful, because he literally has put in the time, he's put in the work ethic, he's taught others to put in the same, and he reads these things top to bottom. And then again, he only understands and invest in the things that he can get his hands around. So find your niche and stick with it. You know, if you were an F-14 pilot and you had a particular tactic that was something that you were good at and you were taught, you just didn't go out and experiment because somebody gave you a hot tip on the way to the flight deck.
Mm. As we're talking about mistakes, I'm reminded of a story a friend told me where she made some mistake and it cost them $7,000, I think, with one of their clients. And, you know, she had trouble sleeping. She really couldn't. She was really worried that she was going to lose her job. And I think at some public meeting, they said, why would we fire you? We just spent $7,000 training you not to make this mistake again.
Exactly. And I tell you something about that particular individual. They exhibited the most important tenet that anybody can take away from the United States military. And there's a lot of hiring of military veterans, et cetera, and it may be a feel-good measure. But I tell you what you're getting when you're hiring a veteran. You're getting an individual that understands the concept of fiduciary behavior. Putting other people's interest ahead of your own, that's exactly the type of behavior that she was exhibiting.
Yeah. In a recent interview, and seemingly increasingly throughout all of the media, there seems to be a sense that America is getting too big for itself or too ambitious. It's one of those, you know, look at the Roman Empire sort of situations. Even they were doing a great job and they burned down to the ground. Do you share that maybe pessimistic sentimentality, or how would you like to see America move forward?
Well, I'm certainly not pessimistic, but I would like to put a little bit of fresh water in the face of everybody in America. And the reality is this, is that we put ourselves in harm's way here. We're racking up a debt that's unsustainable. And ultimately, some of the benefits that are out there are the result of having a successful society. But at some point, you do overextend. You need to draw those things back. And the fear of drawing them back, or the need to go to a foreign nation such as China and just extend so much debt to another nation is only going to make us weaker. And we have to ask ourselves very clearly, are we going to be the nation that our grandparents gave to us, the greatest generation now from World War II, the things that they believed in, they fought for? You know, we've got a 220 plus year head start on capitalism on China. And it's not that we need to take a pessimistic view about America. We need to take rather that same optimistic view that we had coming out of the 70s. And it's not to be political, it's just to state the obvious. Coming out of the early 80s, this was a nation that was questionably in decline at the time. We had incredibly high inflation, et cetera. These aren't things that necessarily we face at this moment. But what took us out of that entire enterprise was the concept that America can rebuild itself. We ultimately still are an entrepreneurial nation, and we know how to build products, services, and come up with innovation. But we're only going to do it if we actually pull together and stop putting our personal interest ahead of those next to us. We need to all be in the game together and not be worrying about the personal stake that we have on a day-to-day basis.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you for your point of view, for writing the book, and for appearing on the show today.
I appreciate it. And if you'd like to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Jeffrey Lay. And you can also find me online at jeffreylay.com.
That was Lieutenant Commander Jeffrey Lay, the author of Top Gun on Wall Street. You can find more about the book at topgunonwallstreet.com. And he's also on Twitter at Jeffrey Lay, J-E-F-F-E-R-Y-L-A-Y. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubek, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.